This podcast is generously supported by Themis Bar Review. For more information about Themis, check out themisbar.com. That is themisbar.com. Thank you very much. And now back to the show.
Welcome to the Legal Theory Podcast. I'm Samuel Moyne. I'm on my own today. David Schleicher, my co-host, usually does these intros, but this is a special episode, which produces as a podcast a conversation I had with Noah Feldman, Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, about his new book, which is called To Be a Jew Today, A New Guide to God, Israel, and the Jewish People. It's always a pleasure to converse with Noah, and I try to engage him about what his book says and whether there are counterarguments. And as always, he's eloquent and interesting, and I hope you'll take a listen. Well, thanks to Avi and the Jewish Law Students Association. Welcome back to Yale Law School, to Noah. You know, even by your high standards, the book we're going to be discussing, To Be a Jew Today, is an extraordinary one. I spent the weekend reading it, and I just want to say a few words in praise of it before I ask you to lay out some of its central ideas. It's accessible. I mean, it's funny at times. You tell jokes, but it's also deep and erudite. The book is analytical, but especially at the end, the last chapter and the conclusion, it is lyrical. It's moving. And I just want to compliment you on achieving so much. It's not short, but it really provides a unifying theory of how we can answer this question, which someone put as why we remain Jews, especially today. And I'll be asking you some questions about your answer, about God and about Israel, which are, you know, central to the book. But I want to begin with just a question about why you start with God in the first place. What unifies your book is what you call a theology of struggle. And it's intended to orient us not just to how we think about the relation of different kinds of Jews. You provide a new classification of us to the divine, even godless Jews, but also it's supposed to orient us when we think about the very contentious matter of Israel and Zionism today. So why don't you begin by explaining why start with God at all as a Jew to think about what our identity is and how we should think about it.
Thank you so much, Sam. I'm going to answer that. I'm going to take 1 second because it's not only a good Jewish principle, but a good Yale Law School principle to recognize in gratitude. And I'm very grateful to Avi and to Joseph for inviting me. Avi read the entire book manuscript and gave me incisive and often very disagreeing comments about it. I'm really grateful for that. I'm really grateful to you, Sam, for taking the time to read it and to engage with it. And since I'm in room 127, I want to express my gratitude also to Professor Owen Fiss, who taught me here in this room in what was certainly the most influential intellectual experience a student could have had, and it's been the basis for an ongoing intellectual relationship for many years. I started with the God topic, in large part because every instinct in me said I shouldn't. You know, sometimes you sit down to write something, and you think to yourself, what's the last thing anyone wants to talk about? And actually, and I started writing this book 3 years before October 7, when you start talking about and thinking about contemporary Jewish life, it's almost universal from the Haredi ultra-Orthodox world to the most progressive Jews, and of course to godless Jews, as I call them, that no one wants to really talk about God very much. It's almost as though when you say the word God, there's an intake of breath and a sense that there's something weird going on and that only weird people would talk about God. And that's and as I say, that's pervasive across a wide range of Jewish experiences. It's not just because of agnosticism. There are people who are confirmed and avowed believers who still think, oh, here we go, if you even say the word God. And that's pretty strange, because whatever else being Jewish is, and it's a bunch of different things, it presents itself as having some relationship to the divine, even a relationship of disbelief, which I think is a very strong relationship. And so when you start thinking about something and it feels like what should in theory be one of the central topics is taboo, you know that that's the thing you have to go towards. I mean, you do this amazingly in all of your books. You always single out on the thing that like no one will say, and then there's the point where you can start delving in. And so that was the real reason that I thought I should do it. And once I did it, I felt that it made sense, because if you're going to ask why be Jewish at all, why remain Jewish, why become Jewish, just why be Jewish? To be a Jew is intended to imply the option of not being. You know, to be or not to be was not very far from my mind when thinking about that title. And it would be very weird if one's entire relation to Jewishness had nothing to do with God. And, you know, even the word Israel has the word, one of the names of God embedded in the end of it. I'm not saying you can't, and I explore many non-God-based ways of being Jewish here, especially Zionism, which is in some sense the most insignificant. It doesn't have to be non-God-based, but for many early Zionists, it was precisely about not focusing on God. So I take those very seriously in the book, but I wanted to begin by asking, you know, what do you think? Asking readers, what do you think? And asking myself what I think.
So you classify Jews in a fourfold way, and I still want to hear how it is that we can nonetheless unify them. I mean, in old American political rhetoric, you're a uniter, not a divider, even though you say there are traditionalists and evolutionists and progressives and godless or non-Jewish Jews. And it's this theology of struggle, which is supposed to be able to unify all of these categories and provide something like a common answer.
Yes.
To why all of them can think, whatever their other differences, that they remain Jews. And just, you know, to anticipate, I'm going to ask some, you know, questions about whether it's late in the day, maybe too late, for this theology of struggle to provide the unification, not just when it comes to God, him, her, it, or their self, but also Israel. So
good.
What is the theology?
Yeah, okay, let me lay out the theology and then...
Which is what I do best, and then Sam will show you that it's insufficient and incoherent, which he also does very well. The theology is this. I'm going to actually start with what the Jews are as a people in order to get to the theology, and I promise to be compact. I postulate that the Jews are a large, loving, and fairly dysfunctional family. And family is where we find our first archetypal experiences of love. And they're also where we ordinarily find our first archetypal experiences of struggle. And in fact, if you look at the Bible itself, the rabbis were interested in the question of why the Bible begins in Genesis and then tells the stories of the forefathers and foremothers instead of skipping straight to the national narrative in Exodus. You know, the Israelites enslaved and then emerging as a people. And it's really striking to me that all of the stories essentially of Genesis are stories of familial dysfunction and familial love. You know, all the way from Cain and Abel through
Isaac and Ishmael and Jacob and Esau, and I'm just touching on the biggest ones, but there's a bunch more. Parents say, I prefer this child to this child. It leads to dysfunction. It leads to hatred. It leads to also the creation of nations. So these are etiological stories, stories about the origins of where peoples come from. And they're all these stories of love and dysfunction. And they culminate for me in the moment where Jacob gets the name Israel. It's not an accident that when we talk about the person Jacob, we call him Jacob, and we talk about the people, we talk about Israel. Even though in theory in the Bible, there's a moment where Jacob is named Israel, and that's the dramatic moment after a full night's struggle with a being who is either an angel or a man or a god or God. And I say that because all four of those words are used in the Bible to describe whom Jacob is struggling with. And in the culmination of this struggle, which among other people, Tony Kushner made extraordinary use of in Angels in America, the being blesses Jacob by saying to him, I'm going to call you Israel because you have struggled or wrestled with God and men, and you have prevailed. And instead of the word prevailed, which I think fits ill with our theology of how one engages with the divine, I use a more literal version of that word, which in Hebrew is tuchal, meaning you were able. And so the core theology is that what makes Jewishness distinctive, not necessarily unique, but distinctive, is that it asks for an engagement with the divine, which could include a denial of the divine, in my view, that is both constantly engaged in struggle and also simultaneously infused by love, in much the way that our family relationships are, whether we like it or not, combining of struggle and love. And the way I try to say that that cabins and includes all of these different movements is to show that each has its own forms of struggle. Within Haredi Judaism, where the existence of God is taken for granted and where the rabbis are thought to have the authoritative say, the struggle is to understand what God actually wants. And the struggle of the study of Torah in all of its beauty and its raucousness is unquestionably a struggle, sometimes an angry struggle. It certainly looks angry. You know, if you walk into the study hall of a great yeshiva, what you'll hear are pairs of people yelling at each other. And it doesn't sound like what you'd expect if you went to, I mean, it actually is what you would find if you went to a Tibetan Buddhist monastery, but it's not sort of what you picture in a Zen monastery, let's say. And that's a struggle. For the Jews I call evolutionists, who believe both that the tradition is normative and also that humans can evolve their interpretation of the tradition, the struggle is to figure out how to work out that relationship. And that's a very noble and very difficult challenge, but it's a struggle. For progressive Jews, it's to figure out how to reconcile the ideals of social justice and of repairing the world with the practice of Jewish tradition, which is not restricted to that. And also to figure out what are the right politics to correspond to that. And for people whom I call godless Jews, the struggle is, if there is no God, and if I'm sure there is no God, why am I doing this? And in some sense, I think that's the most Jewish struggle of all. So I think these are different struggles, but they're cousins. And the claim I want to make is that if you're doing any of these struggles, you're recognizably being a Jew. So that's the argument.
So, you know, a more conventional story of what's happening demographically to the Jewish people today would not take this form.
Yes.
It wouldn't offer the same classification. It would involve, you know, usually some sense of polarization where the middle drops out of Jewish observance. Most especially in the United States, I grew up in a conservative shul, and you know, this is not a movement that has fared well in the intervening decades. Instead, we have traditionalism and neo-traditionalism, what you're willing at some points in the book to talk about in terms of fundamentalism, something common across a lot of different faith communities. And then at the opposite pole, you have disaffiliation, exit, secularization, whatever we want to call it. So this theology is really, I think, attractive because in a sense it restores some options which can be seen as engaging in struggle in different ways. Where I want to put pressure is on the far end, the godless. First I'd invite you to just compare your story to the kind of conventional view of the splitting of Jewry. But when we come to those on the secularizing end, you give a sense that the godless are all like Spinoza or even Marx, for whom the tradition is their nemesis. And they're in a sense denialists who, through their very denial, embrace the struggle. But I just wondered the extent to which that's true of the masses of godless Jews, the heirs of Spinoza, down the generations, who don't seem to be recognizable as engaged in kind of continuing struggle with God, even in rejecting him. So how would we fit them in? The people, like the Jews whom you follow, Yuri Slezkin in his great book, The Jewish Century, and counting as Jews, even though in a sense they want to live beyond Judaism.
Well, let me try to give a two-part answer to the second question. Maybe that'll lead me back to the first. I should lead me back to the first. The first is that there are lots of Jews who don't wake up in the morning and think of what they do for a living as in any way particularly related to or constitutive of their Jewishness, but who nevertheless are trying to find something to fill the role of what a religious faith could look like. A big category here would be socially progressive Jews who, let's say, barely ever go to synagogue or maybe never, feel totally alienated from it, are completely convinced that pursuing social justice is the objective that they ought to pursue in their lives. And maybe they roll their eyes when someone says to them, oh, that's the manifestation of your Jewishness. And I get the eye roll, and I respect it. I mean, one of the things I say in the book is if you want to walk away from being Jewish, you can. I'm very distant from the argument that you're in some Heideggerian way thrown into your Jewishness and you can't walk away from it. To me, that's too close to the idea that the anti-Semite makes the Jew or that you have no choice. Of course you have a choice. When you go off to university, if you want to have nothing to do with Jewishness, you can. And it's not going to be a problem or an issue. But I do think that for many of those Jews who are focusing on social justice, if you just press a little harder and ask why, they might give a culturalist answer. They might say, well, I grew up in a very progressive, social democratic, liberal environment. And, pretty soon they're describing their Bernie Sanders-like values and their Bernie Sanders-like grandparents. And at that point, I feel pretty comfortable in saying that's an identifiable social type that is Jewish. And to the extent you have a normative account of why you are here, if we just go back a few more steps, Jewishness is going to recur. It's going to come up in some sense. And that's enough for me. For everybody except the person who says, absolutely, I'm not a Jew. Your hard question is, what about the person who does not go so far as to say, I'm not a Jew, in a kind of rigorous way where you think, you protest too much? Right? Not so much the, Professor Ackerman used to say this publicly. I don't know if he still does. He would say, he didn't say there's nothing Jewish about me. That would have been a strange thing for him to say. But he certainly would say, I don't consider myself a Jew. I heard him say that publicly many times. And that, to me, had the resonance of protesting too much socioculturally. But you're talking about, the college kid today who maybe had a bar bat mitzvah, and it's just not a factor for them. I would say it's not a factor for them. And here I would point, since we're talking sociologically, to the post-October 7 moment. I wrote the book before October 7, then I went back and significantly rewrote it. I think it's been very hard for people with any connection to Jewishness not to react strongly post-October 7, whether it's to be actively and committedly anti-Israel, or to be actively and committedly pro-Israel, or some complicated combination of connection and critique. There are still people who manage to duck it, and that seems totally fine to me. But I think there are fewer than one would think. And to me, the not in our name formulation precisely suggests connection. Otherwise, why would you be saying that? You know, why would you even have the presumption that it was in your name? So I guess I would concede that this isn't a perfect sociological account, because it's not a sociological account. But I think it does catch a higher percentage of folks than we might initially assume. And I agree with you that we're generationally further from people who insist there is no God. And yet, Sam Harris is out there, you know, I mean, to name the person I would least like to mention in room 127, you know, doing the kind of the new atheism, which turns out to be entirely indistinguishable from the old atheism. There's literally not a single new argument that wasn't there from the 19th century. But it's strident, it's angry, and there's something in the background.
Okay, so I want to turn to Israel, but first ask one final question about the theology of struggle as a proposal for unifying the Jewish people, explaining what they're doing, and in a sense, giving them a sense of how they're doing it as Jews. Because I totally would give you the kind of, you know, those who are motivated by ethics or politics or social justice. I love the way in which, you know, in the best of prophetic traditions, you say towards the end of the book that Jews need to reserve the right to denounce their fellow Jews and remember that that's what the prophets did, and call them back to, if you like, struggle. But what about cultural Jews? Because I detected an ambivalence about whether they're in or lost.
I'm talking about the people.
They're in, on my account.
Bagels, noshing.
Yeah,
Seinfeld.
I have a section where I say, in praise of the bagels and lox Jew.
That's right.
And I really mean that. I think to say I have food ways that I'm attached to is an oblique way of saying I have an identity and a connection that means something to me, and I'm committed to it. And I think, you know, very frequently someone who would say I'm a bagels and lox Jew is someone who would also feel some sense of connection and disconnection with some strength and with some power. So I think they're absolutely in. And in terms of what it means to unite them, I just want to be really clear, lest you think that this is all, you know, dewy-eyed, we all agree. The whole point is that we don't agree. The whole point is that Jews deeply disagree about the things that matter the most, including, you know, what does God, however you understand God, or spirituality, or social justice, take it however you wish, tell us about how we should think about Israel. There is a very intense series of disagreements about that. And the last thing I want to do is suppress that. I want to acknowledge that. What I want everybody to see is that the people on the other side of that debate are coming in good faith and are trying as Jews to make sense of these issues. And so when, you know, Israeli secularists are angry at Israeli Haredim for not serving in the military, and the Haredim say, what do you mean? You know, we're serving the state by our Torah study. I don't want the secularists to do the thing that they do, although decreasingly so, and say, you know, you're crazy, that's absurd, you're freeloaders. I want them to say, you're wrong. We need to be embodied and, you know, instrumentalized and fight in the real world. But I understand that you are sincerely describing your mode of relationship. And similarly, when, you know, Jewish Voice for Peace folks are arguing with pro-Israel Zionists, I want both sides to see, I'm not telling them not to disagree with each other. They have fundamentally opposed views. They ought to disagree. But I want everyone to realize that the other side is coming in good faith insofar as they're trying to make sense of what it is to be Jewish. And that undertaking would change, it would change the feeling tone of the exchange. It's not that it wouldn't still be serious. And it's not even that it wouldn't still be angry. It's fine for Jews to be angry at each other. It's normal. It's a normal set of affairs. It's like a family. But if they remember that they are, in some important sense, family, that should shift in some way the feeling tone, and it should give us more recognition than we presently have. And just to give a concrete example, you know, it'll be Passover in a few weeks, and anywhere where people are bothering to get together for dinner and call it Passover, even if they're not doing it on one of the nights of Passover, which I know lots of people who are like, well, it's Passover is Monday, Tuesday, so we'll do it on Sunday. You know, fine. If you're bothering to call it a Passover meal, there are going to be some serious disagreements this year, like bad ones. And that's okay, because the exchange of doing it is, that's the Passover. That's the experience. That's the Seder. That's the archetype of the family that's arguing with each other. And it's right there in the script for the evening. And it's familial. And that, to me, matters in some important way. So the family could end up screaming at each other. That may happen in my family, probably will. But that's what it is to be Jewish, not only today, but always.
At my Seder, I'm currently prohibited from raising certain topics.
That's also a good solution.
I'm going to inflict your book on those who made those rules. Okay, but on culture, I mean, I totally get that the thesis is about, you know, rambunctious debate within a broader unity that Jews all recognize amongst their fellow Jews. But the unity is provided by a common individual and collective struggle with God. But cultural Jews, I wasn't sure fit that model.
They're not struggling with God.
Because they've lost all touch, even with denial.
But I think, so can I just push back on that? Because I was brought up in a world, a modern Orthodox world, where that's exactly what the line was on cultural Jews. They were assimilated, which was the worst thing you could be. I had no idea what that word meant when I was 6 years old, but it was apparently a very bad thing. I actually think even now people are unclear on whether assimilated means that the Jew has been swallowed up by the culture, the general culture, or whether the Jew has swallowed the general culture. I don't think any people even have a clear, coherent answer to that question. And the more I got out into the world and interacted with assimilated Jews, the more preposterous this account seemed. You know, those same highly assimilated Jews argued intensely about Israel, for example, like they cared about it. Not like they were arguing about Tibet, which they might also have cared about, but there was a certain tenor to the conversation that was pretty darn different, in the same way that there is today, no matter where they were. Those same assimilated Jews wanted people to know that they were cultural Jews. And even the lightest touch, so I have a friend called Michael Alexander, whom I met when he was doing his PhD at Yale, and I was in religious studies, and I was in law school. He's a professor in the University of California at Riverside. And when he read the manuscript of the book, he said, I am like a fan Jew. I'm rooting for a team. The Jews are my team. And I'm rooting for the team. It's like a sports team. And if my kids pick that up, great. And if they don't, it's not the end of the world. And he was trying to push me in some way like this. And my response was, yeah, that's real. I mean, maybe partly because I'm from Boston, where we take our sports really seriously. But that's civic identity. That's connection. That's something you talk about, you know, in the sports bar and on the street and with the taxi driver. It's a unifying feature. It's a cultural form of life. And that's a lot. That's a lot of affective commitment. And that's enough from my assessment.
So a lot of the book is autobiographical. And, you know, as you know, every book is ultimately autobiographical. I want to ask you to say a little bit about that feature of the book, because especially if we're interested in the terms of unity that you defend, it seems to, in a sense, allow you to, you know, claim membership in a way that's uncontroversial. It's not just that you have so much learning about Jewish religious traditions, while maybe inconsistently practicing them. I mean, I've witnessed you break halakha without getting into detail. And
it was just at dinner, really, relax.
That's it. We have the same thing in mind. And then you have a chapter on intermarriage. So I'm not, you know, making this public because you've made it repeatedly public. And I don't know if your current fiance, congratulations, has followed through on her proposal in the New York Times to join the Jews, quote unquote.
She's working on it, yes.
At least once there was
totally
an intermarriage, possibly 100%. Twice. So is this book an apologia pro vita sua?
No. In the sense that I sort of tried that in 2007, and people were really, really, really mad at me about it in an essay that I wrote in the Times. which I intended as a love letter to modern orthodoxy, but it did not reach its intended audience in the way that I hoped that it would reach them. So, but there is a strong personal side to this, and in the chapter that I have in the book about marriage between Jews and non-Jews, I dropped a footnote at the beginning saying there's a lot of my own experience in this chapter, not only mine, but I kind of, after I wrote that article, I got appointed the unofficial rabbi to people who, or counter-rabbi to people who were ready to marry someone who wasn't Jewish. And I've gotten hundreds of calls and had hundreds of conversations with people about this. The book is personal in the sense that I talk about views that I've held. And actually, I think I've held almost every view that I describe in the book at one time or another, and sometimes simultaneously, which can lead to real contradiction. And I think that's one reason that struggle is a leitmotif for me here. Julia, my fiancée, whom you mentioned, has repeatedly said to me, why would anyone want to sign up for a religion that bills itself as love and struggle can't be disentangled? To which my answer is, that's a correct marketing point. I mean, there's, what, almost 2 billion Christians, nearly 2 billion Muslims, you know, hundreds of millions or probably billion Buddhists of one kind or another. All of those traditions hold out the ideal of it all working out. You know, you can have, God can be pure love, or one's relationship to God can be pure obedience to his justice, or one can practice genuine non-attachment and, you know, achieve samsara in some way, at least aspirationally. That's why there aren't very many Jews. It's not the Holocaust. You know, even if those Jews had survived, there would be 25 million Jews. It's because it's not a good marketing strategy to tell people love and struggle are intertwined, because that's not an attractive aspiration. So I am talking about my own struggles in the book, and being Jewish in this sense is for anybody who is okay with, and maybe even secretly likes, the idea that much like our familial relationships, our spiritual relationships also combine these features. So, and with respect to the, I mean, I have a different view today of what marriage and children and all of it feel like and look like now that, you know, my kids are 17 and 18, and I think I can say this publicly, the woman whom I married back in 1999, who wasn't Jewish, recently became Jewish herself, well over a decade after we've been apart, in a kind of a remarkable development. And so, you know, and having been through my kids' bar and bat mitzvahs and the whole tremendous complexity of all of it, I think I have a more nuanced view of it now. That is to say, a view that is more capable of seeing the contradictions and more capable of seeing the value of struggling through the contradictions and of not shooting people down. And I sort of, that's the last thing I'd say about this. My first draft of the book was actually called, before October 7, Bad Jew. And it was kind of a provocative title, but the idea, the substantive argument was, no one should call anyone a bad Jew. Don't even call yourself a bad Jew, the way people kind of humorously, ruefully say, oh, I'm such a bad Jew. Don't say that, you're not. And I guess that was also a message to myself. You know, don't say that to yourself, because it's really hard not to, and also because it's archetypally Jewish to call other people bad Jews. You know, and one of my favorite lines in the book is, you know, the Jesus who said, judge not that ye be not judged, was Jewish. And it's not for nothing that that line has become a very important line in Christianity and not in Judaism. You know, that's not a very, it's not the most Jewish of sentiments.
So agreed, the book is incredibly generous and inclusionary. And does point to, I think, a future in which Jews can see beyond the familial discord they preserve, for sure, but maybe with more acknowledgement of their common outlook. But then there's Israel. So that yep. is the center piece of the book, and obviously the terms of the debate around that have changed since with the modifications you made since October 7th. Just in passing, it's interesting how peripheral the Holocaust is to this book. I would say it enters in the main passages you devote to it to explain other things, like how American Jews could be liberal and Zionist, or how the state of Israel could become possible in the first place. But maybe it's a barometer of our times that the Holocaust is not central to your answer of what could unify the Jews. And indeed, when it comes to Israel, a sense not just of struggle, but of the possibility of sin is. So I want to ask you to kind of spell out, however briefly, that kind of argument, how Israel fits into the book. And then I'll ask a critical question or two, and then we'll throw it open.
Okay, great.
Just very parenthetically, Sam is right in his characterization of how I talk about the Holocaust in the book, but I do say that for progressive American Jews, the Holocaust really became, in the 80s and 90s and up till the present, a central part of Jewish theology, alongside Israel, in fact. A kind of faint echo of the passion and the resurrection transposed into a different key. But I think, and this will get back to Israel, I think if you push me about the Holocaust, I think I would say that seen from a traditionalist Jewish perspective, the scale of the Holocaust is certainly unprecedented in Jewish history. But the structure of the Holocaust as an instantiation of God's apparent willingness, imagining an omnipotent God, to allow the deaths of many, many innocent Jews is a completely recurrent feature, and it's the central problem of Jewish theodicy, and always has been. So the traditionalist answer has always been, on account of our sins, we were exiled from our land. On account of our sins, we underwent this particular destructive practice. And that means that one ought to self-explore and self-examine and try to do better. And that's the response to the theodicy problem. It's a kind of practical functionalist response to the theodicy problem without really solving the underlying theodicy question. Okay, so I'm happy to talk more about that if people would like to talk about it. So what do I say about Israel? What I say is that the old Jewish question of the 19th century evolved to become the Israel question of the present world. And that this happened because the Jewish national story, the narrative of the Jews, which is bound up also in the narratives of Islam and Christianity, evolved both consciously and accidentally into this Israel narrative. And that was necessary for the creation of the state of Israel. It was necessary for Jews to rely on that narrative and to use that narrative, and for Zionists to use that narrative. But also that, and this is not an original point at all, early Zionists had this secular nationalist aspiration to replace Jewishness as a religious or ethnic status with the pure nationalism of Israel. And it didn't work. Israel is a nation state, and that's one of the reasons that the Jews are not a nation, because if you're talking to an Israeli and you're an American Jew, you know they belong to a nation, namely Israel, that you don't belong to. Different language, different culture, different social norms, etc. Even if four generations ago, you know, your great-grandparents were brother and sister. So that narrative of nationalism did a flip. Instead of replacing Jewishness, it infused Jewishness. And nationalism, of which Zionism is a specific type, became for many Jews the reason for being Jewish. Again, see that that's the opposite of what the early Zionists wanted. The early Zionists, the classical secular Zionists, thought, yeah, you don't have to be Jewish because now you'll be a member of a nation state. You'll be normal. You know, you'll be like everybody else. You'll be like an Italian or a German or a French person. And that didn't happen. But nationalism is so powerful as a force in the last 100 years in the world, and it remains so powerful in so many different frameworks, that it's become the reason for being Jewish for many, many, many Jews. Some secular Jews, some godless Jews, some religious Zionist Jews for whom it's absolutely at the beating center, and increasingly even for some Haredi Jews who deny that they are Zionists, even as they increasingly are taking on board some of the ideology of Zionism while disavowing it, while performing it. And that has meant that for Jews to not relate to Israel has become almost impossible. And so I touch in the book on the idea that's sometimes called diasporism, which is like the normative view that it's better to be in the diaspora, which on the surface could seem like a really attractive idea for someone like me who wants Jewishness to be more than nationalism. And I think the difficulty with it, there are a couple of difficulties with it, but the most striking is that the Jewish tradition has never seen the status of being in the diaspora as desirable. They've seen it as normal. There's been the view that Jews should never try to break out of that unless God intervenes, but it's never been treated as the optimal or the desirable state. So it's very hard to pull that move off, appealing though it might otherwise seem. So what's the upshot of this for me? The upshot is that we can take the struggle idea and the consciousness of the possibility of sin, and this is how it connects up to what I was saying about theodicy. We can take those points and use them to infuse our thinking about Israel and begin by acknowledging that God brought the children of Israel out of the desert into the land of Israel, so they knew that God was on their side, and then when they sinned, just as he had told them what happened, they were expelled, put in diaspora. Then they came back, again, God was on their side, they sinned, they were out. So that consciousness of sin should make us realize that even for the most committed Zionist who believes we're in a flowering of the redemption, well, that doesn't preclude the possibility of sin and punishment. And second, to realize that the Jewish tradition is more than nationalism. It may include nationalism, for today it's centrally nationalistic, but it's more than that. It has more options, more possibilities within the bounds of the familial. So please ask the critical, skeptical question.
Well, no, so it's very important to kind of get the nuance of your position, which it does place Israel at the center of contemporary Jewish identity and prospective Jewish identity.
Even for those who are against it. Yeah.
Even for those who are while insisting on the importance of, at times, harsh judgment, you invoke Reinhold Niebuhr to think about the ways in which it's actually Jewish, not Christian, to insist on our own sinfulness, our own potential sinfulness, and the need for harsh self-judgment. But I do want to ask, maybe there's an error of perspective. I mean, you're totally right that October 7th proves that there's the capacity for unification around of the Jewish people globally, around some kind of defense of Israel. On the other hand, I guess I wasn't entirely sold by your rejection of diasporism, which you associate with Daniel Boyarin and Judith Butler, two Berkeley professors. I mean, there is some kind of tradition of diaspora nationalism and prior theorists of diasporism than those two great figures. And I wonder if it might have some, you know, prospects for the future, in spite of the fact that you're right, that it wouldn't be something, let's say, you know, deeply rooted in Jewish political traditions, because it would transvalue diasporism. But then on your own account, there are these other looming realities that I think maybe put pressure on the kind of non-negotiable centrality of Israel.
I don't think it's non-negotiable. I mean, let me just push back on that one thing. First of all, I'm not describing a world post or pre-October 7 where all Jews are united in supporting Israel. To the contrary, I don't think that's what we're seeing right now. I think we're seeing a substantial number of Jews, not all, but mainly younger Jews, whose Jewishness is being expressed through rejection of Israel in very clear terms. So that's the first thing I would say. I just think they're doing it as Jews, and that to me is a significant fact. I also definitely don't think it's non-negotiable. It's very much negotiable. And what makes it tricky to talk about it is that, although my book is mostly not sociological, the Jews are a community and they have views, many Jews have views about what it is to be Jewish. And so that becomes a kind of interpretive community of argument around what counts as Jewish. So imagine that you were like the people, the secular socialist Yiddishists of the late 19th and early 20th centuries in Europe, who created the Institute for Yiddish Wissenschaft, you know, YIVO, which still exists, who participated in the Bund. And you said, look, Jewish life in Eastern Europe is this wide range of like fascinating things of which the Zionists are just one peripheral part. Totally accurate for that. But today, if you created a sociological account of Jews around the world and what they think about and what they care about and what motivates them, Israel would keep on coming up so pervasively that it would become hard to say, well, Israel isn't really central. You have to make it a normative project to say that it's not central, and that itself is very challenging. You know, so there's a difference between today's diasporas and older forms of diasporism, given the rise of Israel, the power of nationalism, and the way it's infused Jewish life. But it's not non-negotiable, and indeed, I want it to be negotiated. You know, I want a Jewishness that has room for Zionist commitment, whether it's secular or religious or ultra-religious, provided it comes with a consciousness of the possibility of sin. But I also want room for forms of Jewishness that say nationalism is not what's getting up out of bed, getting us out of bed in the morning. You know, we're going to synagogue and reserving the commandments because God commanded them. Or we do social justice work because we're inspired by the progressive Jewish ideals of the prophets and of the 19th century German reformers. I want those things too. I want a pluralistic picture to be out there. And I want it to be more pluralistic than it is, because as I at least hint in the book, nationalism has some limits, you know, and it also has some dangers associated with it, real ones of the kind that, you know, the great scholar Gershom Scholem warned about, you know, when he was talking about the revival of the Hebrew language and said, once you start reviving these ideas, you know, you have to take with them their mysticism, their millennialism, and sometimes their fanaticism, and you can't actually expect to successfully suppress all of those.
Okay, I'm taking more of my time and pressing this one for one last second, but yeah, so be it. So in relation to diasporism, you basically say Israel's a fact on the ground, and half of Jewry lives there. But then there are these other things that you stress, and I just wonder how will things look in 50, let alone 100 years. First, the radical redefinition of Zionism. You tell a beautiful, you know, give a beautiful account of the two Rav Kooks and how marginal the first one relative to the second, and you have some interesting discussion of the traditionalist Zionism that kind of dare not speak its Zionism, adopting it de facto even while not de jure. Then, as you say, there's so much progressive disaffiliation with Zionism. You say something similar to what Peter Beinart says in the New York Times today, that liberalism and Zionism once went together. They're splitting apart right now. And the consequences, I think, are grave for the Zionist project. But then secular Zionists, lastly, you say are themselves disaffiliating in certain ways with the state of Israel, especially given what's happening with traditionalists. So, I mean, in the last year, I spent time in Berlin, and never have I heard more Hebrew spoken outside Israel than on the streets of Berlin, Germany. So all of these three things together portend, I think, a very different set of possibilities than we've known in our lifetime.
I agree with that assessment. So I think basically this can go one of two ways, and one of them is much more probable than the other. I mean, there is still a strand of liberal secular Zionism that maybe goes and spends time in Germany, but wishes the state of Israel would be a liberal democracy, goes to the streets, as they did for 9 months before October 7, over a core question of liberal constitutionalism. And they were putting hundreds of thousands of people on the streets multiple times a week. You know, globally, it's very rare for such a high percentage of the population to show up in favor of a liberal democracy. And that's a strand of Israeli society that showed its strength and actually won its fight on the narrow grounds on which it was fighting it. And that is real. And to the extent that that strand in Israeli life could strengthen itself and remain committed to Israel, there is still a chance that, you know, with the right configuration of Saudi pressure, you know, for a peace deal that will require the recognition of some Palestinian state and the right change in attitudes from American politics, there's a chance, I'm not saying it's a high probability, but a chance of the emergence of a more secular democratic Israel alongside a state of Palestine. And that state, I think, would probably gain much more support, not total support by any stretch, from progressive American Jews and maintain the allegiance, this is for sure, of secular Zionist Israelis or post-Zionist Israelis who like living in Israel because it's their home, their country, they love it. And for all their skepticisms, those folks, you know, all over the world, many of them went back, volunteered to serve in reserve units after October 7th on the theory that that's their home. That's the positive picture, and it's not the more probable. The more probable picture is an Israel that becomes increasingly non-liberal and in some instances illiberal and in some instances of people who are in the government, anti-liberal. You know, there's a party, a big party numerically in the Israeli government now called Otzma Yehudit, which translates as Jewish power. It's a Kahanist party. It's derived from the views of Meir Kahana, who is himself influenced by the Black Power movement. So the name is not an accident. It's a transcription of, or translation is indirectly of the name. And, you know, I say in the book, and maybe the thing I mean most strongly in the whole book, that the Bible specifically warns that when you go into the land of Israel and build beautiful homes and live well, say not in your heart, my strength and the power of my right hand hath created this wealth for me. And the word that the biblical verse use, otzem, strength or power, is literally the same word, just with a feminine ending, as the name of the Jewish Power Party, which purports to be a religious party. And that is, in biblical terms, heresy. It's worse than heresy. You know, it's literal sacrilege. It's a direct contradiction of the divine command that every single person who voted for that party knows that verse. Okay? And that strand is a real powerful and growing strand in Israeli life. And if it continues to grow and to bring together ultra-Orthodox with kind of more religious Zionist directions, Israel will lose gradually over time a higher percentage of its liberal Zionists, secularists. It will lose the support of American Jews. It will have to make a play for geopolitical relevance and economic strength, probably without the alliance with Saudi Arabia and without U.S. support in the form that it exists. Can it do that, becoming a kind of second-rate regional power? Yes, I think it can. It still has something to offer China. You know, I mean, this is a region where the Assad regime is still around. We're talking about something far more liberal, far more economically sophisticated, you know, than something like that. So, of course, it can function and operate in the region. But in that world, there will be an increasing bifurcation among the cousins. It'll be impossible even to imagine any unity around that. And then the interesting question is, would American progressive Jews in that environment still care enough about Israel to fight against it? Or would they just say, well, and this has happened at various times in Jewish history, we've got our community, you've got your community, you do your thing, we'll do our thing. Hard to imagine that right now. Hard to imagine real disengagement, but that could happen. That's a scenario that I think is not only possible, but probably slightly more probable than the more optimistic scenario.
Thank you.